Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is no more immune than the rest of America is to the current political and social strife affecting our country. Still, we are movie reviewers, not political scientists, and while we stand with those who preach nonviolence and compassion for our fellow citizens, especially for those who have been systematically oppressed, our aim is to comment on art, particularly the art of cinema, because as has been true since the first humans draw on the walls of caves, art is what reflects the best of what we all can be. Not that everyone agrees on what is good or bad art, which could be the case as the three of us tackle three films that we saw this past week through various streaming services: the Norwegian documentary The Painter and the Thief, the Portuguese meditative drama Vitalina Varela, and the mockumentary The Trip to Greece. Let's begin with an intriguing look at an artist and the criminal whom she befriends. Barbara Kisilkova is a Czech-born artist living in Oslo, Norway. Carl Bertil Nordlund is a Norwegian man struggling with a drug addiction, which has led him into a life of crime. One of his crimes, which we get to witness through closed-circuit security cameras, involves stealing one of Kisilkova's paintings from the art gallery where it was on display. What Norwegian documentary filmmaker Benjamin Rhee explores is the friendship that Kisilkova initiates with Bertil Nordlund in the very courtroom in which he is being prosecuted and continues through his incarceration and beyond. What Rhee gives us seems to be an intimate portrayal of two people in the worlds in which they live. But the access he manages to get, whether in court, in jail, in public, and in private, sometimes seems too good to be real. Then again, maybe my reaction would have been more positive had I not been jaded by the last two decades of second-rate reality TV shows. And let me jump in here real quickly and say, I'm not saying I didn't like The Painter and the Thief. I found it fascinating. I just have some problems with it. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I'll jump in here because that was going to be the first thing I brought up, is that there are shots in this movie and entire scenes in this movie that are so visually beautiful and so expertly framed. And then there are moments that are so almost serendipitous and cinematic that it did make me question how Rhee got this access. And in some cases, whether he should have gotten that access if it was something that he captured on the fly. Because there are moments where we see these characters, especially the thief of the title, The Painter and the Thief, that are so nakedly personal and emotional, especially when he's dealing with his addiction and deciding whether or not he needs to seek recovery, that I did wonder if maybe the film was prying a bit too much, where I was seeing moments that maybe should have been better left private. But then I also started thinking, and I mean, we've seen a lot of documentaries within the last decade that are really pushing the boundaries of the definition of the term documentary. And I think this is one of them, because it does sort of force you to ask yourself what the nature of documentary is in the first place. Does it have a responsibility to show us a completely unvarnished truth? At what point are the subjects guiding the narrative rather than the narrative driving the subjects? And I think what makes this movie interesting in that regard is that that's sort of what the film is about. I mean, this is a movie about the relationship between an artist and a subject and how that relationship changes the art and the way that the subject is portrayed in the art. And I think we see that in the two paintings that she makes of this guy, especially the second one, which ends up being the final shot of the film. We see her portraying him in two completely different ways because she's gotten to know him more in between making these separate pieces of art. So I think the film, you know, I might question how it's put together. And I also wondered if there was some story construction going on here. And when I say construction, I mean things were fabricated in order to push the story along. I don't know if that's true. But I think the movie is sort of about that in a way. And I was able to eventually kind of reconcile that idea because, I mean, that's essentially what the film, The Painter and the Thief, is talking about. So it makes sense that it would be reflective in very way that the film is put together.
Yeah, Nathan, I think you raise an excellent point, because I got the sense at various times that perhaps this was more of a collaborative endeavor. And she is an artist herself. And so I think that, you know, she is a painter, but I was wondering how much involvement she might have had in, you know, what we eventually see. Because this is not really cinema verite by any means, because it's you know, divided into separate sort of, not vignettes, but separate pieces. And so the whole conceit of this film, the fact that a fellow would break into this gallery, steal this painting, and then the artist would make an overture to him, for what purposes, we're not sure. I mean, initially, I thought that she was reaching out to him, hoping that she would find out where the art was hidden. Because one thing we do learn during the course of this film is that he seems to have no recollection. So the so-called thief seems to have no recollection of where the canvas that he removed is currently located.
Like, or he claims to have no recollection.
Correct. Good point. Because, I mean, we suspect that that's probably not the case. Mm-hmm. But so this keeps us and the artist going. But then as we learn, something else develops between them. And Dan, you said early on that you did not think that this was necessarily political. And some of us do have a degree in political science, just putting it out there. But I think that—
Does that make you a political scientist?
Yes, I am a political scientist, self-proclaimed. But it's interesting because this is a commentary in some ways on the criminal justice system in Norway and what that means and what it looks like in terms of the approach to drug addiction, even the corrections process itself. The fact that she could go and talk to this defendant in the case where she is the victim face to face, I found to be fascinating, because I think that really is what a lot of victims want. They want some sort of confrontation. They want some sort of answers from the defendant in their particular case. And that does happen here. Then it sort of turns a little strange, in my opinion, because characters pop in and out of the movie. We see her boyfriend, for example, sort of repeatedly, and then he kind of disappears for a while. The thief's dad shows up at one point and makes a cameo appearance. So I don't know. It was fascinating, Dan, and that was might be the best word to describe this whole endeavor.
Yeah. Now, I mean, as you were referring to, Nathan, one of the age-old problems with documentary, going back to actual cinema verite, to everything that Errol Morris has wrought, is what is real? What is truth? And does the camera itself intruding in particularly intimate moments, how does that affect what we're seeing? Is it a constructed reality? Is it an objective reality? I don't see how it could be objective.
I think it's a slice of reality. So the painter and the thief, I didn't even realize initially when we were talking about doing this film, I didn't realize it was a documentary, because anything that I had heard about it really didn't give me that impression. So that's another aspect of what we see here too.
Well, and there's the whole idea of, you know, and we see this on reality TV, you know, most of it isn't reality, that people behave differently when they know they're on camera.
Yep.
And so even if you're trying to be as objective as possible as a nonfiction filmmaker, your very presence and the fact that your subjects are aware that you are there filming them is going to change things, obviously. And so it's kind of why I wanted to lead with the whole idea of what is the responsibility of nonfiction filmmaking anyway. Everybody seems to have a different idea of what it should be doing.
Well, I think it had, I mean, in most cases, although it was difficult to ascertain here what the director's perspective was, I mean, I think I've always talked about documentaries as, you know, having a specific perspective, you know, so there's slices of reality throughout The Painter and the Thief. But to say it reflects reality, no, because we don't even get a really deep look into everything that's happening in these people's lives. We get a sense of what's happening. We get to see them with individuals with whom they have a relationship. We get to see them maybe walking, painting, whatever, but it's there's no real narrative here. And then, of course, the mystery of where the canvas is located I'm not going to explain what ultimately transpires there. But the other thing we haven't mentioned is that he had a co-defendant. So the thief had a co-defendant in this particular crime. And I did keep waiting for when that person was going to appear. And ultimately, he does show up.
Well, there is, I think, one thing that this movie proves in relation to the power of nonfiction narrative, which is at the end of this film, we can see that these people have made transformations, not just emotionally, but physically as well. I mean, the guy in particular looks totally different by the end of this film than he did at the beginning. So there is that kind of thrill to it, the idea that we are watching real life unfold. It's just
over a four-year period.
Right. So we see real life unfold. It's just, it's clearly structured in a way to give it more of a narrative than real life would have.
Yeah. Well, some of those slices of life that Mary Pat was talking about were truly affecting. I mean, the moment that the guy sees, because the one thing we haven't mentioned, I think, is that she paints him. And when he sees what she has done, that's truly an affecting scene. And
it is.
And hard to believe that he wasn't acting. It was truly a profound
interaction moment.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. We've just been talking about the documentary, The Painter and the Thief. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Vitalina Varela and the trip to Greece. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Bill Simer, past board chair and community volunteer. During the past few months, we've seen many things change in our lives. From working from home to teaching from home, we've managed to change many of our daily activities. But one thing that hasn't changed is Spokane Public Radio. If anything, it's been more of a constant for us than ever before. From news of the world to familiar voices from home, it's been there for us. Favorite programs and programs we've never had time to listen to are now our daily companions. They connect us to each other and to the world. Your support of Spokane Public Radio has never been more important than it is right now. Please go to kpbx.org and click on the red donate button to make a contribution today. Thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Norwegian documentary, The Painter and the Thief. Let's now move to a couple of movies that offer something largely different. The Portuguese exercise in independent cinema, Vitalina Varela, and Michael Winterbottom's addition to his trip series, The Trip to Greece. Let's begin with a bit of Portuguese meditation. I use that term meditation with intention. Like the Swedish filmmaker Roy Anderson, whose film Songs from the Second Floor played at the 2008 Spokane International Film Festival, Pedro Costa, at least with his film Vitalina Varela, is far more interested in scene and mood than in theme and narrative. Costa, though, has not a whit of Anderson's underlying sense of humor. In short, our protagonist, Vitalina Varela, who is played by the Cape Verde actress of the same name, has come from her island home to Portugal proper because her estranged husband has died. Over the next several days, maybe weeks, it's hard to tell, Vitalina haunts her late husband's house, weathers visits by neighbors and the occasional thunderstorm, while attempting to bond with a priest who seems to lack energy both for his faith and for life itself. I'm not sure whether Costa ends his film with the same intention with which he begins it, or whether what he provides us with is an ending at all. What I will take away, though, is the film's memorable visuals and its skillful use of ambient sound.
Yeah, I think I have two distinct disadvantages when it comes to reviewing this movie, Vitalina Varela. The first is that obviously none of us saw this in a theater.
Which is where you should see it, yes.
Yes, because this is a movie that is, I mean, it's got to be one of the darkest, physically darkest movies I've ever seen. In most shots of this film, the characters are completely wrapped in shadow. The shadow seems to be constantly creeping into the frame. And I feel like the richness of these visuals doesn't translate as well on a TV screen, no matter how good your TV is. These were images, and like you said, sound that was designed to be seen in a theater. So, and also the fact that this movie is really, really slow.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if I had been in a theater, I would have become more involved and absorbed in it. The other disadvantage is that I haven't seen any of Pedro Costa's other films. He's one of those filmmakers that I've heard about for a long time and just have never gotten around to catching up with him. And this is apparently, from what I've read, an extension of his earlier work, not just in terms of style, but in terms of its content and its players. So Vitalina Varela, the actress playing, from what we can gather, a fictionalized version of herself, was in Costa's previous film, Horse Money. And so this is sort of like a follow-up to that. And then Ventura, the actor who plays that priest character you talked about, he's apparently a regular presence in Costa's other films and is something of a muse for him. And so I think if I had seen those earlier works, their presence here would have maybe meant something different to me than it does now. As it stands, though, I mean, again, I responded to this movie on a purely visual level more than anything else, because you have these very real people at the center of the frame, but they're surrounded by these sort of abstract, almost modernist backdrops. Like the first image of this movie are these two concrete walls, and then they're just enveloped in total blackness, like the kind of blackness that doesn't exist in nature. And so there is kind of this strange surrealism going on with everything. And then just the image of Vitalina Varela's face, and just she has these monologues where she's talking to, supposedly, I think, the spirit of her late husband, and just the anger and the sadness and the life that go on in her eyes, I think, is a powerful image that I won't forget. The movie itself, though, my hands kind of closed on air, and I think it's just because I didn't have the proper context in watching this. But I'm sure Pedro Costa's fans, if they haven't seen this already, would probably get a lot more out of it than I did. But I mean, it's such a gorgeous movie, and I wish I could have seen it in the theater.
I agree totally, because it's so easy, because of its sort of meditative, slow-moving nature. If you're not totally immersed, it's easy to sort of get distracted by the reality
or bored.
What's in the living room and so forth and so on. What each of you has discussed so far, these contrasts with sound and light at one point, because everything's been shot pretty much in the dark at night. At one point, something happens and daylight emerges, and it's startling. I mean, you're almost shocked.
It's so quiet for a lot of the time, and then there will just be these explosions of ambient sound where it's rain or someone rattling around metal, and it's really startling because it kind of comes out of nowhere, and I think it's designed that way.
No matter what's happening, whoever's talking, always in the background you can hear the mumble of voices in the apartment next door or upstairs or out in the street.
It plays with time and place in these sort of intriguing way. Mm-hmm. So Vitalina Varela, at various points, we don't know exactly if we're talking about the present, if we're talking about or something's happening in the distant past. And it sort of switches venues at one point, because the primary filming might have taken place on a set, but it looks like it's in a favela in Lisbon. And that's the sort of primary location. But then we see other locations. We are not sure exactly about the time frame. We know that there's a connection, for example, with the priest character. And it is partially about the immigrant experience. And although they are coming from the Cape Verde Islands, it's clear that at different points, she can understand the Portuguese, but she can't really fully appreciate everything that's going on around her. She's trying to piece together what her husband's life has been like since they separated. And I was really amazed by this film. But yeah, I hope I can see it again in a theater where it's a more immersive experience.
Yeah. And that was Vitalina Varela, which is streaming through the Magic Lantern website. Let's close with the trip to Greece. By now, following the 24 or so TV episodes and previous films such as The Trip to Italy, and The Trip to Spain, most of us are familiar with Michael Winterbottom's study of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon touring the world, seeing a number of historical sites, eating gourmet meals, and on occasion, romancing the women they meet, all while trying to one-up each other with their comic quips and, best of all, their impersonations. This latest and reportedly last episode in the series, The Trip to Greece, is hardly the place in which to start. It feels almost like an afterthought, an inside joke provided to those of us who've seen the other films and who know these characters, their strengths and weaknesses. That aside, there's always something enjoyable about seeing the sights, the island of Lesbos, for example, and hearing Coogan in particular impersonate Dustin Hoffman playing Dorothy Michaels from Tootsie. If only there were more of that.
Yeah, I don't know what it needed more of, but yeah, this film missed the mark. It was trying to be a little bit more personal, I think, at least in terms of Steve Coogan's actual life. And we do see both of their families at different points. But let's be clear, for those of you who are jonesing for some travel shots and documentaries, this is not a film about Greece. And so, yes, it's filmed in a couple of different spots in Greece, but I would say it's a film about Greek restaurants. and it's a film about this camaraderie between these two individuals. So if you're looking forward to seeing this, as Dan indicated, this should not be your first foray into this series, because I do think that a trip to Spain, and I would argue a trip to Italy or the trip, are far superior products. This had too much going on and too little going on at the same time.
So if you really want to get in your Greek sights, you should watch Mamma Mia 2 is what you're saying, right?
Maybe. Just
okay. Well, yeah. I have to say, I watched this with my wife, who hasn't seen any of the other trip movies, and I've seen all four of them now, and she was able to kind of keep up and thought it was pretty funny. So I don't know. I didn't think this one was markedly better or worse than any of the other sequels. I thought they've all been about like B-minus movies. I like hanging out with these guys, but like if this is the last one, I'll be okay with that. I do have to say, though, that they got me with the Tootsie bit, because, you know, that's one of my favorite movies, and it was great to hear him do Dorothy Michaels. But
also, my favorite part was Coogan doing Ray Winston doing Henry VIII.
Yes, that yes.
Hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of more of the same, but yeah, I thought it was all right.
And that was The Trip to Greece, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Painter and the Thief and Vitalina Varela. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again explore the world of streaming cinema. Until then, remember these words from Oscar Wilde: life imitates art far more than art imitates life. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.